You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
UNICEF estimates that worldwide over 1,200,000 children enter the sex trade every year. Belarus, Russia, Ukraine, Albania, Bulgaria, Romania, China, Thailand, Nigeria are among the countries with the highest trafficking. And although there is an awareness that it's taking place in those countries, it's less well known that in the United States, an estimated 250,000 adolescents are also at risk of exploitation each year. Rachel Lloyd, a survivor of the sex trade industry and founder of the Girls Educational and Mentoring Services, or GEMS, tells her own harrowing story and the stories of other young women in the life in Girls Like Us, Fighting for a World Where Girls Are Not for Sale. An activist finds her calling and heals herself. It's published by HarperCollins, and I'm very pleased that it brings Rachel Lloyd to our show today. Hello.
Thanks for having me.
You're from Portsmouth, England, and you left home when you were just 13 years old. Why?
There was a lot of alcoholism in my home. When I was little, my mother was a single parent and didn't drink and was really a good mom. She remarried a guy she'd been married to before, who at the time I thought was my father. He was a raging alcoholic, and it didn't take long before, I mean, he beat her on their honeymoon, and she was drinking not long after that.
Did you have any other siblings or No. extended family members who might have helped you?
No, I mean, my grandmother was, you know, a strong influence in my life, but I think just at her age felt kind of overwhelmed to deal with me and my mother's problems.
So here you are, 13 years old. How do you wind up in Munich?
I didn't get to Munich actually until I was like 17. The first few years that I left home, I was just kind of, I was in Portsmouth and I was, you know, stealing and doing credit cards and, you know, everything that I could to get by, working in factories, working in restaurants. Getting to Munich was a really snap decision, the kind that teenagers make. I met some girls in a pub one night after I'd had a big fight and gotten beaten up by my boyfriend. And they said, oh, we live in Munich and it's great and you can get a job as a chambermaid and work in a hotel. And 3-4 days later, I got on a bus and went and bought a one-way ticket.
Well, it was a city that many British people thought was the beginning of success because the Beatles had become famous.
I don't know if that affected it.
But they didn't work in a sex club. You became a hostess in a sex club.
Yeah, I mean, I got out there with, you know, some big plans and discovered that, A, I didn't speak German. B, I was under the age of 18. And whilst in England I'd been able to, you know, work illegally with a fake social security number, I didn't know how to do that in Germany. And not speaking the language was really kind of a hindrance. So after a couple of weeks, I hung out for a couple of weeks looking for jobs, got down to my last kind of 2 marks and no food, no cigarettes, and walked into a club and said, look, I'll dance for a couple of weeks and make enough money to get back home. And 2 weeks turned into a couple of years.
Because you didn't just wind up dancing.
No. I mean, and you know, looking back, right, how naive I was around that. And so they said, well, you can't start as a dancer. You start as a hostess. And you just talk to customers and you drink and you make them buy champagne. And that's kind of it. And so I was like, I mean, and at this point, right, I was 17. I was already an alcoholic. And I felt like this is easy. You get drunk. You get paid to get drunk. And then I think after my first customer, right, that was what happened. Second customer took me into VIP, and it became very clear that the expectations were higher than, just buying alcohol. And, you know, I think that first day, I mean, it was kind of like a numbing experience. And you think, okay, like, I've just got to get through the next couple of weeks and get home. I had a one-way ticket. I was stuck. And I didn't have the type of family that you called and said, oh, made a mistake.
And you couldn't save money?
That was the plan for the first couple of weeks. But then it becomes, right, I did go back to England for a visit, thinking I would probably go back home. And everybody in my town knew. I had a friend who told everybody. And so all of a sudden I was like the prostitute, you know, And I mean, there was nothing to go back to England for at that point either.
Well, you were working in the equivalent of a brothel, weren't you?
It was a strip club, yeah. A dance club.
And then did you begin to date a Gulf War veteran?
Yeah, I met him about a probably about six months in. And, you know, he was my boyfriend. I mean, I was madly in love with him. And,
an American?
Yeah.
And a crack addict.
At the time, I didn't realize that. Yeah. He was handsome and smart and, you know, had a deal actually at that point with Sony, because he had an amazing voice. And so, right, it seemed like a great relationship. And then very quickly, it became clear that, yes, he had some serious drug problems, and that he was not kind of, it wasn't a choice about giving him money.
He was acting as your pimp.
Yeah.
To pay for his habit.
Yeah.
The question people most often ask when they hear about girls and women who are being abused by spouses, boyfriends, or pimps is why they don't just leave. Can you explain some of the tactics used by abusers to keep women trapped within this cycle of abuse?
I mean, I think there's the practical considerations. And I mean, right, for me at that point, I was in a foreign country, you know, didn't have anything to go back to. And a lot of people who end up in abusive situations, right, are coming from abusive situations. So it feels really normal. And I think
But you could have gone to London and got a job as a, you know, an entry-level sales girl or something.
Yeah, I mean, that's where I'd kind of come from. And so, you know, I think there was a real challenge for me in kind of going back. I think, though, at the time, right, I loved him. I was scared of him. I believed that he would tell me that no matter where I went, he would find me and kill me if I left. And I'd seen enough of his violence to believe that to be absolutely true. I was convinced that he would one day kill me.
Whatever happened to him?
Yeah, he's stateside. He ended up, he had to leave Germany because the police were looking for him. That gave me enough time to kind of breathe a little bit. I was supposed to join him later and, you know, it just gave me enough time to get out. He has struggled. I mean, he has some mental health issues and some substance abuse issues and, you know.
And you stayed in Munich for about 6 years or so.
No, I was in, I was in Mainz, which is by Wiesbaden. I stayed for about 5 years in the end. I was in the sex industry for about 2 years, and then I ended up becoming a nanny and living on a military base, American military base.
And then you came to America at 23?
Yeah, 22. 22.
With the help of a British missionary group. Did you find them or did they find you?
No, it's actually... I knew that I wanted to kind of come to the States. I was working in youth ministry at my church at that point, and I thought I wanted to come to Texas and work in youth ministry. I wanted somewhere sunny, and I was applying for, having grown up in England and then Germany, I was applying for jobs with various churches and organizations, and someone called and said, oh, I know this woman, she's British. She works with women coming out of the sex industry. You should call her. And there was nothing on my resume about, like, my one-line resume about my past. And so it seemed kind of like fate. And so I called 6 weeks later. I came out with a job and was being supported at that point by my church in Germany. And
then you were able to get yourself an education.
Yeah, I mean, one of the first, it always really bothered me that I dropped out of school so young and made, you know, and I felt like on some level I was smart, but I felt, you know, embarrassed around people and there were big spots of my education that I knew I'd missed. And so as soon as I got here, I registered for a GED prep program up in Harlem, at a church up in Harlem, and studied for months on the math component because that was the one that was kicking my ass and took my GED, got a high score, and got a full scholarship to go to Marymount Manhattan College.
Rachel Lloyd has written a book called Girls Like Us, Fighting for a World Where Girls Are Not for Sale, An Activist Finds Her Calling and Heals Herself. It is published by HarperCollins. So then you started GEMS. This is a big leap.
So that first year I was working for an organization that was working with adult women coming out of the sex industry. So I was going, my first week in New York, first week in America, I went to Rikers Island and told my story to a bunch of women. And that was the first time I'd ever even told my story out loud to anyone. But as I was going to Rikers and working up at Hunts Point and, you know, working, targeting adult women, but kept bumping into really young girls, and I was 22. And so I had more in common with and could relate better to the younger girls.
And they had come out of similar situations where there was substance abuse, family problems, poverty. But you started older than many of these kids. Some of these kids begin at the age of 11. You talk in the book about helping girls as young as 11, and that the average age of entering the sex trade is 12 to 14.
Yeah, I mean,
that's just barely out of puberty.
Yeah. You know, and I mean, in the book, right, I talk about the meeting this 11-year-old who just, it just blew me away. I mean, how much of a child she still really was. I think one of the challenges, though, right, is that we're beginning to have some empathy over the last few years for kind of the 12, 13, 14-year-olds, but God forbid, right, 15, 16, 17, 18, even though, right, many of those young people, A, entered the sex industry younger, and even if they didn't, the life circumstances that brought them there are the same.
Well, how does a barely pubescent girl get lured into the sex trade industry?
By a man, frankly. I mean, it's generally a boyfriend-type situation. It's generally kind of this seduction process where and the thing is, I mean, and this is a conversation I have a lot with the girls, right, is that the fact that he's been kind to you and he feels like the nicest thing that's ever happened in your life and this feels like the most love is not indicative of what a great guy he is. It's indicative of how terribly adults have failed you up until this point. And so, I mean,
somebody's paying attention to you.
Yeah, I mean, and it feels real, right? If you haven't experienced good, healthy nurturing and love, when this guy comes along and offers to support you and love you and care for you and feed you, and this feels like love. It feels like family. It feels like everything you've ever wanted.
But it goes from that to being lured into a van or an apartment where there are a half dozen guys waiting.
Yeah, I mean, it could start like that. It could start like, look, I just need you to do this one time with this one guy. And sometimes it's the pimp pays a friend to come and pretend to be a customer, and it's even his own money. And that's the thing, right? Once that line has been crossed, it's really a slippery slope from that point on.
Well, there are laws in the books that prevent statutory rape. Does that protect these underage girls from sex with older men?
No, I mean, right now in New York, and this is one of the things that with a bunch of other organizations we're going to be pushing for over the next year or so, is that the penalties for adult men who buy sex from minors isn't equivalent to adult men who have sex with minors and stat rape charges. And it's only in the last year that New York State, and we became the first state in the nation to correct our legislation that prosecuted 11, 12, 13-year-old girls for having been bought for sex by an adult man instead of being treated as a victim.
So in the past, they were just treated as prostitutes, even though they were 12 years old?
Yes.
And thrown into jail?
Juvenile detention, yes.
You write that the sexual exploitation of children in other countries is often perceived as being worse than what takes place here, but your experiences suggest something else.
Yeah, I mean, and I think, right, it's a tricky thing when you begin to try and compare victims, right? But, I mean, what we see with young people in this country is, you know, when we think about trafficking and girls being brought into this country and their ID being taken, their families being threatened, incredible levels of violence, not having control over their own money or their own time and where they go. That's the exact same thing that we see with domestically trafficked girls.
But do you think that police in New York or in this country are more sensitive to the situation now?
No, that's my short answer. I think there are a handful of cops who really take this seriously. And right, there's some folks that I mention in the book who have been phenomenal. And in fact, the book is dedicated to one of the young women who passed away and Detective Adam Frassi, who was an NYPD detective that we've worked with for years. But that's not the norm, unfortunately. Like these cops who go over and above and see girls as victims and see them as, right, this could be my daughter, that's definitely not the norm.
I'm speaking with Rachel Lloyd, who's the founder of GEMS, Girls Education and Mentoring Service, the largest program to help girls leave the sex industry in the United States. She's won numerous awards, been featured in a documentary, and now she's written a book called Girls Like Us, Fighting for a World Where Girls Are Not for Sale, An Activist Finds Her Calling and Heals Herself. It's published by HarperCollins. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Rachel Lloyd, her book, Girls Like Us, which is published by HarperCollins. You talk about some of the things, questions that are typically asked by well-meaning outsiders that you feel are wrong. Maybe we can go through a few of those. Why doesn't she just leave, and why would someone want to turn all of her money over to a pimp?
The why doesn't she just leave, and we just talked about that a few minutes ago. I think on some level we've gotten much better about asking that about domestic violence, right? That used to be the kind of standard response. And I think over the years, our understanding of the fact that there are a lot of psychological dynamics that keep women in these situations, and it's not that easy.
You say brainwashing techniques.
Yeah. But then we're also talking about young people. We're talking about girls who've experienced trauma and abuse prior to entry into the sex industry. And then you're talking about pimps who's, right, their soul, with a batterer, with an abuser, right? He has a job outside of the home, right? He batters and he goes to work. This is a pimp's soul job, right, is to make her loyal, to make her compliant, to make her submissive. And so he's putting, you know, a lot of energy and time into that. And the tactics that pimps use, I talk about Biden's chart of coercion, which is a tool that was developed by Amnesty International to look at prisoners of war, and the torture tactics that are used on them. It's the same thing that pimps use.
You also write that pimps are often the victim of sexual abuse themselves.
Yeah, my pimp's father had been a pimp, and his, right? Now in retrospect, I'm able to kind of understand.
You write about Angelina in the book, who makes a list of the pros and cons of life with her pimp. And she, among the cons, she wrote, he hit me and he makes me have sex with other men. And the pros include Cheetos, because her pimp once bought her a snack at a corner store.
I remember.
Doesn't
that
seem like a fair balance.
No, right? And that's why we did, right? The pros and cons list. I did that when I first left my abuser. And, right, it was startling to me, like, what I thought was okay. And so that's one of the reasons that we do that with girls. But that Cheetos conversation, I remember that so clearly, because she was sincere. She was like, you know, he knew it was my favorite and I was crying and he went to the store and he came back and he had Cheetos and chocolate Yoo-Hoo. And I was like waiting for the rest of the story, and that was it. And so, if that to a young person feels like love, right? Goodness, what has she experienced in her life to get to that point?
You write about the popularity of pimp and hoe parties on college campuses. How is that being a pimp or being a hoe become glamorous? What do you think is the appeal for the girls who engage in those kinds of games?
I don't know if we really see that on all female campuses, right? I think there's a desire to be seen as going along with kind of what the dominant culture wants. And our dominant culture is a masculine culture that sexualizes women. And so, you know, there's an idea that you have to be sexy in order to be appealing to men. I think that most young people, adults even, if you say the word pimp, they're not thinking about an adult man who's beaten on, right? Like, they're thinking about something in a movie. They're thinking about like a very 70s kind of Mac image of
with a big hat
and a fur coat, and it's funny and it's cool. And we could have a whole nother conversation about the racial dynamics there, and right, like,
well, how important is the racial dynamics? Your offices are in Harlem. But I've just been reading about all of these prostitutes whose bodies have turned up in Long Island, and they're all white girls. Is there a racial dynamic here?
Yeah, I think that I've been watching the Long Island stuff, and I've been interested by that. It's not to say that there aren't white girls and white women in the commercial sex industry. What we find is, and right, it, it, depending on the area and the location and right who's kind of at risk depends. But in large urban areas, right, we see race and class are kind of tied in. And so the folks living in poverty tend to be young people of color. What we see in rural areas is it's low-income white girls who are targeted for exploitation.
You're right that a tipping point for the popularity of pimps came in 2003 when 50 Cent released his platinum-selling song P.I.M.P. Was that before Reebok gave him a $50 million sneaker deal?
Yes.
So they gave it to him because he was such a success?
Yeah, I mean, he was, I mean, at that point, you couldn't go anywhere. I can remember 2003 really clearly, and you could not go anywhere without hearing that pumping from, you know, not just a car stereo, but like in a store, right? I mean, it was totally socially acceptable. I mean, and if you really listen and break down the words, I mean, you know, in the Lloyd Banks verse, he talks about, I don't have to give her much, she happy with Mickey D's. Like, really, you're talking about adult women who have choices? I mean, right, like, most adult women aren't happy with McDonald's. Like,
yeah, but how that was a song. How effective do you think that was in actually convincing women to go into the sex trade?
I don't necessarily think it was, like, effective in convincing women to go into the sex trade. I think it was very effective in pushing the envelope towards glamorizing pimp culture and for boys growing up believing that this is cool and glamorous and sexy.
Rachel Lloyd's book is Girls Like Us. It is published by HarperCollins. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, in December 2006, Rolling Stone featured a picture of Snoop Dogg in a Santa Claus red hat and a copy line that read, America's most lovable pimp. Doesn't Snoop brag about his pimping, which he claims he took up when he already had a successful rap career because it had been a childhood dream?
Yeah. I mean,
that is weird. But he's bragging about engaging in illegal activities. Would that make him liable to prosecution?
I mean, I guess it could. I mean, nobody has ever, to my knowledge, nobody has ever called him on that. I mean, I think it's the fact that, right, as a culture, we think that it's okay to, I mean, the Oscar going to Hard Out Here for Pimp, right? I mean, over the last few years, we've really seen this kind of shift in the acceptance of pimp culture and the normalization of sexual exploitation. And, yeah, I mean, the fact that Snoop gets to have endorsement deals and, right, it's totally socially acceptable that he can talk about pimping and promote Chrysler. Mm-hmm. I mean, if he was talking about raping women or beating women, right, I don't know if we would see that same thing.
It's also in vitamin water. How did vitamin water play a role in this?
That's 50 Cent's endorsement, right? I mean, he's been an incredibly successful businessman. And I mean, right, how much of hip-hop is kind of exaggerating, you know, the culture and how much, I mean, Snoop is a little bit different in that he speaks specifically about having actually been a pimp and makes no bones about it and has never demonstrated any remorse for that.
So has it become an uphill battle to make people see how unglamorous a life of sexual exploitation actually is?
I think for the girls who experience it, right? I mean, I think it's very, very clear very quickly how unglamorous it is. I mean, I think once you break it down for people, I think people just haven't really thought about it, right? When we use pimp as a verb and, you know, and people bobbing their head to a song, they're not really thinking about kind of the impact that has on young people.
Well, you write in the book about reframing the language of how we refer to the girls and women who are in the sex trade. What kind of language would you like to see employed?
I mean, I think, right, we wouldn't have seen a song, It's Hard Out Here for a Trafficker, win an Oscar, right? I mean, that just wouldn't have happened. And so when we talk about young people in the sex industry and adult women, frankly, who are under the control of a pimp as trafficking victims, when we talk about this as commercial sexual exploitation or exploited youth, right, that's something that happens to you. When you call girls a prostitute, I mean, to call a young person a prostitute just denotes a level of choice that they just don't legally, socially, you know, developmentally have.
Would you call her just victim?
Yeah, I mean, we talk about girls as victims, but I mean, we also, right, the goal is to help people move to a survivor as well.
Have you met any young women who had a goal of becoming prostitutes?
No. I mean, no, right? This isn't something that you grow up thinking is ever going to happen to you.
Mm-hmm. What about the other side? You've had women go through your GEMS program. Is there a recidivism rate? How many return?
Well, we have about a 72-71% success rate in helping girls exit the commercial sex industry. I mean, we know that, like domestic violence, there's often a cycle of going back to the abuser until kind of the new transformation kind of kicks in. And so, right, the girls go back, but then we're still there and we continue to support them.
Is part of the problem that most of them can't go back to their families because that's where the problems began?
It's a big problem. I mean, it's a large part of the problem. I mean, I also think the trauma bond with the abuser is so strong. If he's done, quote unquote, a good job, right, she is incredibly loyal to him and is scared to leave and, right, feels like this is kind of it for her. And I mean, when girls leave, how they're treated by their family, the community, society in general, if you feel like you're being called a prostitute, you're dirty, you're nasty, you're a criminal, right? Why would you try to be in that world? Why wouldn't you go back to where at least you're accepted?
And where you have a sense of family.
Yes.
Have you been in contact with your own family?
Yeah, I have. I mean, my grandmother passed last year. But my mother and I speak kind of every day. I mean, she's been sober at this point for 17 years. She and I have worked very, very hard on our relationship over the years, and I'm really grateful for the relationship we have now. It took a long time. I mean, I'm in my mid-30s at this point. It's only in the last couple of years that we've really gotten there.
When a girl comes into GEMS, what's the first thing you do to help her rethink the way her life has proceeded?
I think it's more about modeling. And right, so when a girl comes into GEMS, she meets the receptionist who was in the life and was under the control of a pimp. And then she reads an article about me as the executive director, the boss who was in the life and was under control of a pimp. And then she meets our outreach team who, right? And I think as she begins to see models of girls and women who've successfully made it out, you're not meeting anybody who's successfully made it out when you're in the life. So you don't have an idea that that could be possible. And then it's about showering that young person with love. And I mean, girls talk about GEMS as a family. And in order for girls to leave one thing, they've got to have something to replace it. And so it's really about building that community and letting her know it wasn't her fault.
You also have fought for changes in the laws. You said that New York State has some of the best laws.
We were the first to pass safe harbor laws. Five states have since passed legislation that stops criminalizing underage children for an act of prostitution that they can't legally consent to. There's other laws pending across the country. Hopefully we will see that.
And what happens when a girl is arrested in states that have safe harbor laws?
I mean, right now, a young person in New York would be arrested and would go to court, and that case would be converted to a PINS petition, a person in need of supervision, so it becomes a child welfare case. I mean, and over the years, right, we've tried to build in a lot more alternatives for what that looks like for a young person, because we know that juvenile detention is not meeting her psychological, physical, emotional needs.
Rachel Lloyd's book, Girls Like Us, Fighting for a World Where Girls Are Not for Sale, An Activist Finds Her Calling and Heals Herself. It's published by HarperCollins, and I want to thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you for having me.